back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the senior citizen edition of Back to the Bins. I am Paul Spataro, and I'm joined by two of my, are we sextagenarians? Is that what it would be?
Whoa. I don't know what kind of show you think this is, Paul, but I am not a sextagenarian of any kind. Not with you, not with Darren. I'm sorry. I'm out.
Yeah, I was going to
so
say.
So now I just have Darren on with me.
If Ruth is listening to this, I'm in serious trouble.
I know in the 70s it's septuagenarian, correct?
Yep.
What is it in the 60s?
I think you're right. But I hadn't thought about it until now.
So Professor Allen, in one of his rare moments of consciousness, suggested that we do an episode of Back to the Bins with himself and me and Darren Sutherland, as we have all crossed that threshold of the 60-year-old mark, which makes us different in our own way. Although I am finding that the comic collectors in general are older than they were in years gone by. It's no longer the young person's hobby that it once was, which saddens me because it means it's going to eventually just go away. It showed up as a blank screen there.
Yeah. I was just confirming you were correct.
All right. So, you know, but I like to be correct once in a while.
What I have found, one of the most liberating aspects of turning 60, and Darren can attest to this because we hung out a month or two ago, is that I've been letting out Grumpy Alan more often. So I can.
Grumpy Paul is a frequent flash, but Grumpy Paul doesn't really expose himself on podcasting that much. We did talk about doing the Get Off My Lawn cast for a while, and we've had a couple of episodes that would probably qualify for that, but we generally try to be more upbeat in our recording. But I took Alan's idea and I tried to take it a step further, and I suggested, well, what if each of us comes up with a book that came out the month we were born? Surprisingly, I actually found one that came out the day I was born. It's not that it's a good book, but then it's not necessarily that I'm a good person either. Any other thoughts about being over 60, guys?
Well, I would say, Paul, I think Alan and I shared when we were meeting together, we shared a thought that, you know, should we title this after Grumpy Old Men, those wonderful movies with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, you know, like grumpy old comic fans. So, all through high school, it was interesting. Way back in high school, I was multiple times voted most pessimistic. I never quite understood why, because I'm absolutely not pessimistic. I do consider myself a realist and very pragmatic. Mm-hmm. And I think probably teenagers just didn't know the difference between those two things and a pessimist. So I kept getting voted most pessimistic, but I still find myself to be a very positive person. So I am planning to be the counter on the other side of the spectrum from the two of you during this.
Not that difficult to do, really.
I just think, you know, just in Darren's, you know, just talking about Darren, I just think it's great that Ruth has really stood strong these last few months, having to pick up the slack for her unemployed layabout husband. I just think that needs to be acknowledged.
I agree 100,000%.
Because I think one of us on this call still works full time. I don't
remember. Well, I think one of us is technically employed full time, but I'm not sure he does any work.
Ooh. you're not a taxpayer in my state, so you don't get to make that joke.
If you lived a little closer, I would bring you over some aloe to put on that burn. It's, you know, I still work part-time. I'm still trying to decide, am I a part-time worker or am I semi-retired.
Ooh.
I'm not sure which term I prefer. But I'm generally, what I'm doing at this point is I'm, most days, there are exceptions, but most days I work until about noon and then I'm done for the day. And it's a, you know, my wife says, why'd you retire if you're going to work so much? I'm not really working that much.
That's great. That gets you time to get a nap in before the early bird special. So that's good. Good thinking.
I am a fan of the afternoon nap. But in my defense, in my 60s defense, I also liked taking naps when I was in my 20s. I didn't mind, you know, like if I went out on a given night, the next day I'd be watching TV and I just kind of doze off and enjoy the relaxation. So I'm not so sure that it has anything to do with my age as much as my sloth-like existence. So for what it's worth, today I chose Justice League of America number 16. And according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, it has a cover date of December of 1962, but it was released on October 30th of 1962, which is the day that my parents gave the world me.
You were released that day as well.
So the title of the story is called The Cavern of Deadly Spheres, and the cover shows the Justice League, which consists of Green Lantern, John Johns, Aquaman, Flash, Wonder Woman, Green Arrow, and the Atom. That's not necessarily everybody who's in the book, but that's who's on the cover. And each one of them is in a sphere. And there is a man on a big organ in the background. And out of the pipes of the organ, there's spheres being coming out. Kind of a weird cover, if you ask me, but all right. The story is written by Gardner Fox, penciled by Mike Sikowski, inked by Bernie Sachs. The synopsis is as follows. A new criminal named the Maestro has been pulling off crimes by arming his hired thugs with musical instruments that compel all in earshot to uncontrollably dance. After each member of the Justice League successfully stop each heist, they decide to take their fight directly to the Maestro himself. Tracking the Maestro to his hidden cave headquarters, all of the JLA members are trapped in indestructible bubbles. Example, Superman's is made out of green kryptonite. However, it is revealed that this tale came from a fan of the Justice League that challenged himself with imagining how the Justice League might be defeated. The Justice League answers the challenge and imagines how they might counter their fan scenario. In the end, the Atom finds the weakness in the imaginary villain, and they anticipate that Maestro might have access to Superman's weakness. So, in the imaginary tale, the team coats Superman in lead in advance, allowing him limited protection to the kryptonite bubble. While the Maestro is busy gloating over his victory, Superman is able to break free and save the others, and they all easily defeat the Maestro and turn him over to the police. Once the solution is reached, Snapper Carr is tasked with logging the story and sending the Justice League's fan word of how his favorite heroes could even foil his perfect plan. So, in the grand scheme of things, I think my birth was a better gift to the world than this comic. I have to say, This is a very silly story, but this goes to, you know, DC Comics in that era was gearing their books for people who were probably in the 6 to 10 year old range. And I think this kind of story probably fits that mentality. First of all, I did get a kick. I can't say I didn't. Out of the different dances that they would all break into. And I was like, the artwork actually made me feel like I could envision what they were doing. And as I'm saying this on the screen right now, it's a shame this is only an audio podcast because Professor Allen is busting off his most John Travolta-like moves.
I'm filming it to share it with the world.
Do you get the feeling that Gardner Fox realized this wasn't the greatest story he'd ever come up with, so he's just going to blame Snapper Carr for it? Yeah, no, Snapper Carr wrote this. I didn't. This was no.
I must say that I was maybe slightly enjoying this more than you did, Paul, through the first twist. When we think it's still a real story and you get the first twist of, it isn't really the music that's making them lose control and dance. It's, you know, something else. I did like that aspect.
I agree with you.
Yeah, that was a neat twist. When they got to the second twist that none of this is real, it's just a fan wrote this, I was just like, oh man, this is just bad. Now I'm disappointed.
It's also that they were so concerned over the fact, oh my God, this fan came up with something. You know, what happens now if there is a maestro out there? You know, it makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, while Rick Jones doesn't bother me, Snapper Carr, his DC counterpart, does. And I think it's the snapping the fingers that just, it's like, stop, please, just stop with the snapping. I don't know. And then he talks like he is a true member of the league. Yeah, they defeated us. They defeated you. They defeat you with a little slap. Please.
But I do think Gardner Fox was also right about one thing. These Generation Zs and their so-called music, it just drives them to do the craziest of things. They need to stop that, and they should get off my lawn. I am fully on board with this story, actually, Paul. It works if you're 60 or you're 6. Maybe not in between as much.
Well, I think it worked for Alan, whether he's 60 or 6, but I'm not sure about anyone else.
I'm thinking you were reading this book and you and Mrs. Quarterbin got up and just cut a little rug.
You still can't stop.
I can't stop.
I agree, though, Darren, with what you were saying, though. There is a creativity to the thought that, you know, you make them think that you're doing one thing, but that's not what you're doing. So when they're working so hard to stop that one thing, they're not going to stop you.
Right.
I do like that aspect of it. And I think that's clever. And I think if a real villain had come up with that instead of a imaginary Justice League fan created villain, I think you pretty much hit the nail on the head. The fact that it's not a real story, and of course I understand that all not real, but you know, it's not even real within their world. I think takes away the import of it, and it makes it just seem even sillier than it already was.
Yep.
And from this, Dial H was born.
Hmm.
All right, taking your reader submissions.
Which I can't say I like or dislike, because I never really found myself reading Dial H.
Uh-oh. I know somebody in Australia who just stopped listening.
I'm sorry. Come back. So overall, like I said, I think my parents gave a better gift to the world.
I agree.
So I'll give my ratings on it. I actually like the cover. I think the cover is laid out really well. It's not your typical cover, and that's, I think, what I like most about it. It would catch my eye because of the different nature of the way it appears. The heroes towards the front, except for the Atom, who's smaller than the rest, are all facing away from the reader. The only ones who are facing towards the reader are behind that, and that's Aquaman and John Johns. They don't show enough of the maestro to make him, make you feel bothered by his existence. And the cavern, as it's drawn on the cover, looks very cool. Mm-hmm. So I really do like the cover, and I would probably give the cover a solid B, maybe even up to a B+. The interior art is workmanlike. It gets the job done. And like I said, when they show them dancing, I actually kind of could envision the steps that they were making. So I'm going to bump it up slightly because of that, because it did help my imagination. But there are some anatomy things where, you know, like Superman looks fat and stuff. So I can't rate it too high. I think I would probably give it a C+, but the dancing is going to make me come up to a B-. And the story, I'm sorry, the story is a C at best. I can't give it any better than an average grade. In fact, it's probably a C-. Overall, carrying more on the virtue of the cover, I'm going to give it a B.
I'll chime in with mine, and I'll say so much of what you said are exactly my notes that I've taken down here. I honestly quite liked the cover. Just like you said, I feel the characters are all sort of on model on the cover. Everybody looks like themselves, and I like the perspective and depth in the cavern. It really does feel three-dimensional. I think it's a very intriguing cover and made me look forward to the story. I think the one problem with the cover is the maestro. He doesn't look very good. He looks a little wonky, I guess I would say, but thankfully he's way back in the background. You don't really see him very well, but I really quite like the cover. The interior art, though, I was really let down by. I think I wrote down two pages that I thought characters looked okay, which was page 5 and page 11. But most of the time, the characters really looked, they looked stiff. Their torsos weren't well proportioned. Nobody had a waist. They just sort of looked like, I'm not sure. None of them looked on model. I was really surprised how few images I really liked on the interior art. And the story, like I said earlier, I was sort of enjoying it as a good, you know, Silver Age, silly fun through the first twist. But by the time they got to the second twist, I was like, oh, you know, this silliness now is just not worth my time silliness with the second twist. So I was really disappointed. I think the cover, I probably give it a little higher. I think I gave it an A-. The interior art, I gave a B-. The story, I gave a B-, and overall, I gave a B.
Yeah, I agree that the cover is the best part of this, and I'm not as much my impression of this era as actually having looked through Mike's Amazing World around this time, but my sense is that covers of this era had a lot of words on them. And I like that this one is almost, you know, a clean virgin cover almost.
Yeah.
I mean, you just have the, you know, banner at the top and the bottom. So and that just strikes me as really rare. And that does give the opportunity for, like Paul said, to put these characters in different positions, different angles. You know, there's literally room for the artist to work. So I like that. So, you know, to me, it's a B+ on the cover. You know, the art on the inside, you try to, you know, rate or judge or critique based on the era. And it's not necessarily my favorite era for art in comics. And I'm not even sure it's up to those standards, as you guys pointed out. So that's in the B minus range. The story, and looking at this era, Silver Age, you know, sometimes I give a story extra credit, like a bonus points when it's delightfully wacky. Like, you know, the delightful part can take it over the edge, but this one was a bit more on the eye rolling version of wacky as opposed to the lovable version of wacky. So yeah, you know, B-, C+, C maybe. I think overall it's a low B, maybe a B-, but you know, everyone knows I'm an easy grader. I mean, except my students. Everyone else knows that. So I give it a low B. You know, kind of like Paul, it's representative of the era, but that it in and of itself is not enough to elevate it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm representative of Darren.
What? I didn't say what do you mean? I didn't say that. I wouldn't. I don't know what you're driving at.
All right, fair enough. So back to our theme. The next book that would have been released. Professor Allen, do you like the fact that you're the baby of this group?
See, here's the thing, Paul. I think you misinterpreted what I said. I thought we should do a generations with the three of us. You know, an old guy, a middle-aged guy, and a young guy. I'm not sure where you got this, everyone over 60. I don't, that's not.
So you're saying you're not over 60. Is that what you're saying for the record?
I'm saying I'm still the baby of the group, although I'm not sure. Who were those demons that the JLA fight? Abnegast and those three. Darren made a deal with one of them to look much younger than us.
But, and yes,
not that sure how that happened.
If I didn't know any of us, and you said which one of these three is the youngest, I'd have no issue at all. I'd go right to Darren. But then again, I'm the oldest, and I think you look older than me. So whatever.
But I act the least mature, so.
Oh, that is correct.
That is what Mrs. Cordovan always tells us. So, Darren, you have the next book.
So I am up next. Okay. So I was very excited. I might be giving away Professor Allen's book just slightly, but I'll just say I was very excited that when we each chose our issues, one person chose a DC book, one person chose a Marvel book, and I chose an independent book, which is very much on brand for me. anyone that listens to our podcast knows I'm a fan of adventure comics and sci-fi comics and fantasy comics more than superhero comics. I like superhero comics, but the others I like more. So I was very happy when I looked to see what book was on the shelf new the week I was born. And I was excited to see that the day before I was born, there was a brand new issue of The Phantom on the shelf. So I'm covering an issue of The Phantom today from Gold Key Comics, issue number 14, cover dated October 1965. But according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, it was on the shelf new on August 5th, 1965. The issue features two separate stories, so I'll cover those back to back here, The Historian and Grandpa. And Gold Key wasn't really great at this point in time in giving credits, so I had to do some research to find the credits. The interior art is by Bill Leonante, who also wrote both stories. However, both stories are based on story arcs from the Phantom Daily Comics from about 10 years earlier in the 1950s. Those original stories were written by the Phantom creator Lee Falk. Sadly, I could not find any credit for who did the colors. And then Bill Harris was the editor on the book at this point in time, and he did occasionally write the issues, but all of the information I found during my research suggested that artist Bill Leonante wrote both of these stories, and Bill Harris was the editor only on this book. So we'll start with the cover. As is often the case with Gold Key Comics at the time, we're treated to an amazing painted cover by George Wilson. In the foreground, we have the Phantom and his faithful gray wolf named Devil. The Phantom has one of his pistols drawn, and it's at the ready. And then we see a close-up image of the Phantom skull ring that's sort of being used artistically to encircle and highlight a group of armed men that are entering a native village with their weapons drawn. Moving on next to the first story, The Historian. This story focuses on the Jungle Patrol, which is a group that helps protect the area and was founded by an earlier incarnation of the Phantom, who secretly acts as the group's commander by leaving instructions in a secret safe. Dr. Hegg is a historian who has arrived to gather information to write a book about the Jungle Patrol, but he's frustrated because no one will tell him who the commander is. So Dr. Hegg hires a local nightclub singer named Jade to romance one of the members of the Jungle Patrol, Lieutenant Smith, also known as Smitty. Of course, the Phantom's already figured out what's going on, and He leaves a message in the safe explaining that Dr. Hegg is actually a spy sent to gather information about the patrol and that Jade is an innocent accomplice and being manipulated by the spy. Jade is shocked to learn this because she really thought she was just gathering innocent information for a historian, but Dr. Hegg now has leverage over her and Smitty, and he gets the information he wants. And even though they don't know much, the little bit of information they provide Dr. Hegg helps him figure out there's a tunnel underground that leads from an abandoned well to the secret safe where instructions are left for the Jungle Patrol. Hegg uses this information to leave false instructions for the Jungle Patrol, causing them to withdraw from the area, which allows pirates and thieves to move in. Of course, the Phantom's been watching all along, and he closely follows and ambushes both Hegg and the man who hired him, turning them into the Jungle Patrol, who have now suddenly received new orders from their secret commander to return to the area and resume their duties. Next up, we have a summary for the second story, Grandpa. This story starts at the home of Diana Palmer. She's been the Phantom's love interest since the beginning of the Daily Comics back in the 1930s. Diana's grandfather has arrived for a visit, and he immediately wants to know why a beautiful young woman like Diana isn't married yet, of course. Diana's mother, Lily, tries to redirect the conversation, explaining that Diana already has a sweetheart who is the legendary Phantom, and he even visits their home occasionally. This doesn't satisfy the grandfather, however, and he uses his personnel department at his large international company to find a suitable man for Diana, since one day she will be his heir. The grandfather sets it up that they're going to go on a hunting trip in the Rockies, and he's going to accompany them. And at the Rockies, Diana and the young man are hiking through the forest when they encounter a grizzly bear that charges toward them, and then they see a second bear approaching from another direction. The young man has trouble with his rifle, but Diana calmly takes aim and fires at the charging grizzly, but can only wound it, so the bears continue their approach. But thankfully for the two of them, the Phantom chose the night before to visit the Palmer home and learned about this trip from the Diana's mother, Lily. So suddenly he steps into view with his faithful wolf companion named Devil. As Devil keeps one of the bears preoccupied, the Phantom dispatches the first bear and then turns to the other, forcing it to topple into a stream. Later, the grandfather, Diana, and the young man are back at their cabin, and the grandfather can't believe that he saw a single man fighting two bears. But just then, two men burst into the cabin with weapons at the ready. They recognize Palmer when he arrived, and they plan to take Diana hostage to force Palmer to pay them a ransom. Suddenly, two shots ring out, and it's the Phantom who is fired. He's knocking the weapons from both of the kidnappers' hands. The Phantom then steps into view and knocks both men out with one punch each. And at dinner a few days later, Diana listens to her grandfather rave about the Phantom, and Diana's mother laughs and says, "Welcome to the Phantom Fan Club." All right. I can move on with a few of my thoughts before the two of you share yours. First, I'll just say that, again, I was very excited to see that this was a Phantom comic on the shelf. I've been a fan of the comic my whole the character my whole life. I'm a fan of the comics. I'm a fan of the character itself. I'm a fan of the movie even. I didn't even have to search for this comic when I found it on Mike's Amazing World of Comics, because Hermes Press reprinted all of these comics, digitally remastered just a few years ago. So I already owned all of these in my collection. So this issue was very easy for me to find. I'll just do a really quick rundown for anyone who isn't familiar with the Phantom, since it's not a superhero comic. It's been around since 1936. The comic is still published today, Daily Comics and Sundays, so this is the character's 90th anniversary. Lee Falk, who created the character, worked on the comics from 1936 until he passed away in 1999. Our good Professor Allen here actually gave me just recently Phantom Number Zero, a new monthly comic book from Mad Cave Studios, so I've been reading those as well, picking that up, so thank you, Professor Allen. And the Phantom is considered a transitional character. Just to give you a little history, he's a transitional character between pulp heroes like the Shadow and Zorro and Doc Savage to superheroes like Batman and Superman. This character was the first ever to wear a skin-tight outfit like superheroes always do. And he was also the first character to be drawn not showing any eye pupils when he wears a mask. So now you've got a little bit of information about the character himself, just giving you a little bit of thoughts on this comic. I'll say this is not my favorite issue of The Phantom by any stretch. I would describe both of these stories as B stories. They're both backup stories and barely feature The Phantom. I think maybe it would have been better if both of these were the second story in two separate issues that each had an A story that featured The Phantom more. But that said, they're very entertaining backup stories, lots of great information, and I enjoy them overall, and we get to learn about some minor Phantom characters that some people may not know.
Yeah, and instead of focusing on this comic specifically first, I do want to briefly concur with Darren that The Phantom is just a great concept.
Oh, yeah.
You've got a multi-generational aspect of the character. Allows you to tell stories featuring the quote-unquote same character from like the days of exploration, pirate adventures, the world wars, and even into the future. So it's a concept that is just a terrific story engine. It just has that potential. It's a robust concept. And you know, I think that probably is one of the main reasons why this is one of the characters that has really stuck from that pulp era. The costume is pretty slick. The image of that ring with the skull on it, it's just a great iconic look. And let's be honest, the ghost who walks, come on. That's a great like subtitle or catchphrase. And like Darren said, the recent Phantom, that was the Free Comic Book Day issue in 2025, was that issue zero. And I'm not the only one who said this, but it is just a terrific one-off, complete, full 25, whatever it is, page story.
It really is. Beautifully drawn, well-written, absolutely good.
I have to say, I do not have a lot of familiarity with The Phantom. Professor Allen and I recently did an episode where we focused on The Shadow. And conceptually, The Shadow, The Phantom, The Spirit, you know, all of these characters just kind of all Doc Savage, even they all kind of blend for me a little bit, because I've never really had much focus on any one of them. So when I read them, I have to kind of try and pay a little attention to catch up with what distinguishes this hero from the others. In particular, his diagonally striped underwear that he wears over his costume, I think, is really creating a look that I just find fascinating. It's a sartorial choice that I would have to question whether it be in 1936 or 2026. It's interesting to look at like the cover art, which is like a painted image. Like the positioning of the Phantom, he always looks like he's a little hunchbacked. So it's just like a strange, like I don't know, a little bit of a strange choice. The art in within Darren, did you say that was like from the newspaper strips?
The interior art, the interior stories are based on original newspaper stories, but they've been completely rewritten and redrawn. Yes.
And do we know who drew this?
Bill Lignante drew this.
Okay, yes, that's okay. Because I'm not familiar with him, but it definitely has the feel of a newspaper strip as far as the art goes, and then it's been colored after the fact. Mm-hmm. It was interesting for me, more so just kind of to familiarize myself with this character a little bit. In the first story, it's like, why are they so gung-ho to find out who the chief is? It almost seems like in its own way it's a MacGuffin. It's like, let's just come up with something for them to be doing. But it was interesting, and then kind of the way he just dances around it, maybe I'm the leader, maybe I'm not, all of that. I found that to be entertaining. It was a fun read. that's pretty much the way I would distinguish it. It was a fun read. You know, I don't know that I felt any more import than that. And sometimes when I read these books with, again, the spirit, the shadow, the specter, not the specter, you know, the phantom, I always hope to get one of like the seminal stories so that I could say, oh, this is why everybody was so enamored with them. I don't think this is that story, but I would imagine there's one out there somewhere that I'll come across at some point.
I definitely would say you're right. Just like I said, both of these are backup stories, even though they were featured in the Daily Comic Strip in the 50s. But you're right. These are stories. One's about the Jungle Patrol and one's about Diana Palmer. And neither one of them is about the Phantom. So he's barely in either one of them. So I can't understand why you feel that way. So I was both excited and then sort of like, oh, well, this is a good read. It's really enjoyable, but it's not the best issue that I would have liked to have talked about.
So going into the third book, which we're not quite ready for yet, but my thoughts are, okay, on the month I was born, I was better than the book that came out. The month you were born, you're better than the book.
I don't like the way
the
this
month
is
that
going.
Alan was born is one of the best stories ever, and he pales in comparison.
I was going to say exactly two right. Classics came out that same week, but okay, however you want to phrase it.
Oh goodness! Well, I'll give my art review and ratings just so we can move forward. We talked about the cover a little bit. I absolutely love this cover. It's by George Wilson, who was known as the beautiful painter. He painted so many wonderful covers for Dell and Gold Key Comics in the 50s through the 70s. He was sort of known for doing non-superhero covers, which is why I saw so much of his work growing up, because, you know, I was buying Star Trek and Lost in Space and Twilight Zone and Tales of Mystery. So he was painting those covers, and he always credited Alex Raymond's Flash Gordon as the inspiration for his art style, which I just love. So I love the cover. You talked about not being familiar with Bill Unanue, and I wasn't either. So it was interesting to read a little bit about him. He worked on the daily comic strip Ozark Ike in the 1950s and then became a temporary fill-in artist on the Phantom in the early 60s, which is why then he was chosen by Gold Key to do the monthly comic book when they started it. And he stayed with the comic, The Phantom, for several years from its move from Gold Key to King Comics to Charlton Comics. And interesting to know a little bit more about him, he also, during the 60s, while he was working on this, he was an animator for Hanna-Barbera. But what he's best known for is he left comics to become the courtroom artist for ABC News. And he did that for 26 years. So he actually apparently was very well known for that. So though I wasn't familiar with him myself, I would give the cover an A+. I know what you're saying, Paul, about sort of the profile view of the Phantom, but I just think it's a gorgeous painted cover. The interior art, I probably would give a B+. I think it's very serviceable. It looks very much like the Phantom daily comic strip, just like you said. I'm sure that's what they were going for. They just wanted to be familiar and look like the comic strip everybody's reading in the newspaper. But I think it's really well done. The comic, the characters are on model. The art's clear. It advances the story. There's a few gorgeous backgrounds. The illustrations of the bears, I thought were a little wonky. But that's really, I credit that to the fact that I'm so familiar with Mike Grell's art, and nobody in comics draws animals and wildlife like Mike Grell. So I would give the interior art probably a B+. The story I would give a B for backup stories, because they both are. I think overall I would give it a B+, because that cover really pulls it up in my mind.
Yeah, I agree with the cover for sure. I love the way the ring is used, kind of oversized, you know, to serve as that window or that frame for the action. I just think it's really well designed and also well executed. Like you said, Gold Key. Charlton also sometimes would go all in, you know, on those painted covers to sort of grab that spinner rack, eyeballs. I think the cover is the best thing about the issue. That's partially a commentary on, you know, the blandness, I would say, of the rest of it, but also a commentary on just how great that cover is. I think it's terrific. You know, again, I'm not as familiar or as expert on the Phantom as Darren is, but I've certainly read more, it sounds like, than Paul has. So it's not, you know, a great Phantom story. I just think that's a great Phantom cover. To me, yes. It's borderline iconic. That's an A, the cover. I think, you know, interior art, it's certainly a step down. It's workmanlike. It's solid, sort of what you'd expect from, I mean, frankly, a second tier, right? You know, title or company of the era. So there's only so high that I could go, but B, sure, that's a B. To me, the story's C, maybe even on the low end of C. I don't think either one's particularly strong, either as a comic story in general, or even worse, as Phantom stories. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's hard to pull that up to any level, maybe mm-hmm. even a C minus. So C plus probably is what I'd go for, probably partially, as you were saying also, Darren, the expectations of, ooh, a Phantom story from the 60s. Okay. This could be, well, it wasn't that. It was okay. So what I say, C plus-ish overall, and part of that is me, I tend to grade story higher than the other categories. So, you know, the cover and the interior art, those are like quizzes, but the story's the final exam, you know, carries a lot more weight in my grading. So that's where I'd land on it.
All right. As the person the least familiar with the Phantom, I had hopes that this was going to be a story that was going to kind of give me the familiarity that I lacked. So that's where my disappointment comes in. It's more on a personal level than on a story level that I'm disappointed. You know, I was looking for it to fill holes that not every issue is going to fill by any stretch of the imagination, unless you go with that theory of this. Every issue is somebody's first. So we're going to just be repetitive and repeat the same storylines over and over again for the new reader, because to heck with the people who have been coming here, you know, consistently and loyally. The cover, I kind of wish, I love the painted covers. I love the gold key covers. There's a lot of issues that I would buy based on the cover artwork from those gold key books that I really wouldn't even have all that much interest about what's inside them. It's just the covers that would compel me to buy them. I just wish the Phantom looked a little bit more intimidating on it. He doesn't quite strike as tough of a pose as I would hope. But overall, I mean, it's still very, very well painted and drawn. I especially like, as you mentioned, Darren, the dog. I think the dog looks great. And the dog looks a lot more threatening than the Phantom does, actually. So I'm going to give the cover a solid B. And I, you know, because it is painted well, despite whatever criticisms I have. The interior art, I do like the fact that it kind of it apes that comic strip look that you would get. So I think it serves its purpose that way. I'm going to say a B minus on the interior art. The stories, unfortunately, are kind of negligible. I didn't really find them to be as compelling as I would have liked. So I'm going to say that they're just passing. You know, they're average at best. I'm going to give them a C. And overall, I'll give the book a B minus. So as the years slowly went past, Mrs. Middleton, Ma Middleton, ripe with child, in the early era of Marvel Comics, gave birth to one of the future educators of the world.
And Stan Lee and Steve Ditko gave birth to a pretty epic storyline. And a pretty epic conclusion to a storyline. We are looking at Amazing Spider-Man 33, cover dated February 1966, but available November 11th, 1965. And just 3 days later, I was available.
For considerably more than 12 cents.
Absolutely. You know, there's some days my mom would have gladly taken 12 cents for me.
I'm sure she would have dropped you in the quarter bin in a heartbeat.
I'm sure there's days where your mother would have gladly paid 12 cents to get somebody to take you.
Please, please. No, this is, as you said, it's the newest book here from the youngest, most energetic member of the crew this time. The cover by Steve Ditko shows Spider-Man trapped under fallen wreckage and debris, the water rising ominously. The final chapter. And, you know, sometimes when, you know, a man of a certain age, you know, old guy, he just sort of starts a story and just gets talking. It just seems like they keep talking on and on and on and on forever. Anyway, I just
don't know
that.
What that's like.
No reason. I just mentioned that. I'm not going to call this a summary. We're going to recount this issue, fellas. So this is the final chapter, plotted and drawn by Steve Ditko, scripted by Stan Lee. And you know how Marvel of this era was known for being a little bombastic in the over-the-top hype that they would give to stories that they could never actually ever hope to live up to? Well, at the bottom of this first page, we are told that this is possibly one of the most thoroughly satisfying Spider-Man sagas you have ever thrilled to. And spoilers, for once at least, Stan Lee's salesman patter might actually be understating the case just a little bit. So we start with a page that recaps the prior two issues. As Peter Parker's Aunt May lies dying in the hospital, victim of the effects of radioactivity in her bloodstream, a sympathetic Dr. Connors waits for Spider-Man to bring the ISO 36 to him. For it is the only serum which might save Peter's aunt. But the stolen serum is in possession of Dr. Octopus, whose masked henchmen wait outside a steel door. Spidey and Doc Ock battle within, and none suspect that a hidden leak in the underwater dome of the hidden hideout is growing bigger and bigger. Spider-Man is trapped by tons of fallen steel, the precious serum just out of reach. I failed just now when it counted the most. I failed, but I can't give up. I must keep trying. I must. And during this latest reread, for the first time ever, I realized what a whining complainer Spider-Man is. Cowboy up, young son. Come on. This younger generation. I just don't get them. So Spidey, of course, finds it in himself to raise the giant mechanism trapping him, to rid himself of guilt given by Uncle Ben's death, to save Aunt May. Because sometimes a little tough love is what the younger generation needs. I mean, kids these days. Anyway, this is seriously an iconic four pages. And this is like the start of the story. But Ditko adjusts the pacing. We got a 7-page panel, a 6-page panel, a 4-page panel, and then finally the full-on legendary splash page on page 5, which is pretty great considering Ditko himself was only in his late 30s, which is what I like to call basically still in diapers. So as Spidey exits, his leg is hurt, but he is able to grab the serum, and soon the lab is flooded with whooshing water, and he lets himself be swept along the current. But before he can make his way to the surface, he finds henchmen waiting for him underwater. But when the hard-pressed youth finally climbs to safety, he realizes that the ordeal is still far from over. More of them waiting for me. And in a 3-page fight sequence that maybe would be iconic if not for the 4-page sequence earlier, the struggling teen makes mincemeat of the henchmen and makes his way to Kurt Connors' lab with the serum. It works. The deterioration of the blood was instantly checked when the serum was applied. Connors phones the hospital to approve the serum Spider-Man is delivering. They won't know for sure if the serum works and, you know, if the transfusion is going to take for like 2 more hours. But Spidey is nothing if not a multitasker. So he goes back to take pictures for the Daily Bugle and phones Frederick Foswell to get the scoop of the year. Peter delivers pictures to J.K. Simmons. Sorry, J. Jonah Jameson. Betty Brant is shocked to see Peter bruised and beaten, which he says is from trying to get pictures. She fears that she'd lose an adventurous Peter Parker the way she did her brother. I couldn't bear that heartbreak again. It's too much to ask, too much for a girl to have to endure. Because young kids were emo long before we ever had a word for it. Peter then barters with Jameson on the pictures, which the seasoned professional business executive rightly determines is highway robbery. But out of the goodness of his heart, he decides to pay the young punk $100 a picture, which deep down he knows will be enough to cover Aunt May's hospital bills, as well as the scientific equipment he pawned off, you know, last issue to buy the ISO 36. It's just another example of the value that this type of mentoring experience offers, that only a certain amount of living, of age, of wisdom, of maturity can bring. And after getting the money, Pete heads to the hospital to find the results on Aunt May. And while he's being looked at for his own injuries, a nurse announces that the results are in. It seems ISO 36 has cured Aunt May after all. And after making sure that his dear aunt is out of danger, Peter Parker goes home to get some well-deserved rest. Because Peter Parker rightly understands, you know, for a young person, that he needs to make sure that the elders in his life are well provided for, taken care of, and treated with dignity and respect. The end.
I think Elm turned it off during that last part.
I'm just saying, the older I get, you know, the more sometimes when I used to identify with the younger person on a TV show or movie or comic book, I started to think the older fella might have some things to say too. But this obviously is a classic. The 13th Dimension website called The Opening Pages, one of the greatest sequences in Spidey history, and also Steve Ditko's crowning moment. And the Marvel website says the scene would go on to help define Spider-Man for all time. And then in 2014, when Marvel compiled their 75th anniversary list of the best 75 Marvel comics published ever from fan votes, this landed at number 35. So,
and I would argue it might have finished higher if not for immediacy bias.
I think so. Yeah, that's fair.
One of the things I liked about Steve Ditko's art, and I like now, as opposed to liked in the past, because I didn't have really reason to like it in the past, is that, you know, Peter's supposed to be 15, 16, something, somewhere in that range. His aunt is drawn as if she's 90. So it's good because she's older than the three of us, possibly even combined. This is one of the great stories of all time. I mean, it really is. It's the whole aspect of it, how, you know, he has to kind of mentally overcome it. It's got that, you know, the adrenaline flowing, the mother lifting the car off the child, you know, that you always hear tell of it, you know, through over the years. The artwork, I think, is phenomenal in this book, on top of the story being so good. One of the things I typically like about Ditko's work is that he creates a film noir feel in a lot of his stories. The shadows, the way that he plays with them, and you know, a lot of his stories had to do with the, you know, the crime syndicates and whatever. So it really went with that. This does not have that, and yet it's still outstanding. So we've eliminated the thing that really stands out for me with Ditko, and it's still a great, great artistic work. The progression of the panels, and like you said, the going from, you know, whatever it is, seven panels on a page to six panels to five panels, you know, to one or to four to one. And then the last one, that's a very atypical Spider-Man in that picture. He's muscular. He's you know, and it's because of what he's doing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's making every muscle strain and stand out, as opposed to, you know, when he normally draws him and he's a little bit more lanky and you know, lithe. You know, he's not really muscle bound. Then, you know, then the progression from there with him limping and the water dripping and the fight with the goons. It's just all so well laid out and so well paced in the storytelling. You know, it's amazing how much dialogue Stan managed to work into this book, because he really didn't need much at all. Yeah. The pictures really do tell the story.
That's actually such a good point, Paul, because, you know, for everything that I, all my notes that I wrote down about how much I love this and what I thought about all the art and stuff, the one thing that seemed obtrusive to me was the fact that there was too much dialogue sometimes, or too much internal narration sometimes, because the flow was so good from the art. And I sort of found sometimes the internal narration a bit distracting.
I don't disagree with you. And anybody mm-hmm. who's listened to this show for any length of time knows how much I love Stan Lee's work. So it's not, you know, it's not really a typical criticism of Stan Lee. He's not the one I criticize for being overly verbose in his dialogue. There's, you know, Roy Thomas. Ooh, there's a guy who gave too much, too many words in his book. And of course he learned from Stan, but that's besides the point. I think Stan often, when it came to Ditko and when it came to Kirby, he was actually a lot of times the steadying factor to take their stories and make them more relatable and mm-hmm. work with them. So I give him a lot of credit where people try to discredit him now, because I do think it was truly a collaborative effort when Stan worked with Ditko and with Kirby, despite the fact that he and Ditko clearly had different ideas in mind and would clash over the work. But just the same, I think, you know, they made a combustible but terrific combination. And I think this story does... It's overly wordy, but the words never got intrusive for me and never bothered mm-hmm. me. So I'm kind of okay with it. And there's so much story packed in here too, between, you know, that first scene with the getting out of from under the thing, then fighting the guys, then talking to Jameson, then talking to Betty Brant, then going over and working with Kurt Connors, and then the hospital. And there's just so much going on in you know, those short pages, and yet it doesn't feel overly compressed. It feels like it has, you know, the pictures plus the dialogue do give it a chance to breathe, as far as I'm concerned. So I think this is just an absolute masterpiece of a book.
And I'm not sure when it started. I'm just looking at the trade. I'm looking at starts at 31, the start of this arc. But at that point, actually, it's only in 32 and 33 where Ditko is credited as plotting, in addition to art. And so he's given plotting credit on this one and the one before, which I know is something he fought for quite some time. And I mean, many people may know by about 6 months from here, he is not on the title anymore. Ditko, 37 or 38. This is 33 we're looking at. Maybe 37 or 38 was his final one.
But 39 was the first of the two Green Goblin stories. 38, mm-hmm. I think, was a guy named Joe, I think. And 37, I'm having a tough time picturing what that was. So I can't tell you.
It was, though. I just, it is so appropriate for him to have plotting credit on this, because if nothing else, and I'm not saying there was nothing else, but if nothing else, just the way the artwork tells this story is plotting the story, because the artwork drives this story. And you know that he has to be involved in the writing, because that's the way it has to flow. And it does so beautifully here.
38 was the last Ditko story. It was a guy named Joe.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it just taking a quick glance, I mean, I'm not reading through them, but of 37 and 38, it really felt like Ditko was just kind of like, okay, I'm going to just, even 36, I'm just going to kind of go through the motions a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're not that they're bad, but they're not. He certainly, on Spider-Man, hit his artistic peak in this book that we're covering here.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
And from there, we all got older.
You know, Paul, this is something I don't think I've ever done this on Bins before. And I know I've never done it in my real life at work, but I'm going A's across the board. The only hesitation I have is that the interior art may be an A+. Mm. But matter of fact, Paul, this is so good, I'm going to make up a whole different scale. Are you ready? Amazing Spider-Man 33 is Jaws.
I'm gonna heartily agree with you. I think this is one, an all-time great book. This art story, you know, it's the culmination of a three-part story. But if you didn't read the first two, you're still not gonna feel lost. But if you read the first two, you don't feel like you're being bogged down with, you know, recaps of what already went on. So I think it's just so well done on all fronts. I'm going to say this is just an A+ book. Anything to add, Darren? On the green?
I was nodding. That doesn't help on a podcast. So
Paul was nodding off earlier. So
I had noted for the cover specifically, I gave an A+. For the interior art, interestingly, I gave an A overall just because I wanted to be able to differentiate that pages 2 through 7 were an A+, and the rest I gave an A because I just felt there needed to be a differentiation from those 6 pages and the rest of the book, because you can tell his art's amazing, but you can tell that he spent the majority of the time drawing this book on those 6 pages. So that's the reason I gave the interior art an A, was just to differentiate pages 2 through 7 with A+. The story I gave an A- simply because I felt the narration was a bit obtrusive, but I just marked it down to an A- for that. And I gave the book overall an A. So we got A+, A-, A. So
fair enough.
Darren voted most pessimistic on the episode. Interesting.
Exactly. What in the world is pessimistic about A+, A-?
So when Spider-Man is sitting there with, you know, holding up this thing and the water's coming in, you're saying that this tunnel is half full. No, we're saying it's half full. You're saying it's half empty.
Oh, man. I feel... How can you acknowledge what's the best if you don't acknowledge what's not the best? That's all I did.
Man, I guess, you know,
grumpy that is... Darren. Man, oh man, harsh. No, just
nobody go on Darren's lawn.
He might give you an A-. Oh my goodness.
Well, you know, to some of my students, that is the worst thing ever. How did I do that?
I thought Alan was the harsh grader.
And he's only going to give you an A- if you spend too much time narrating what the art already shows.
Well, I mean, there is the theory of show, don't tell. So you know,
I'm give, a big proponent give, of show don't tell.
Give the readers credit for being able to figure certain things, you know, certain things out on their own. So yeah, I mean, I get it. I don't think the word balloons or the internal monologue is intrusive. So I'm still good with it, but it's getting late and I need a nap because I'm old. we're gonna call an end to the episode. I want to thank you guys for coming on and doing this. This was a lot of fun, and you know, at our age, we got to grab every bit of fun we can get.
Oh man, hanging out with you two makes me so feel so youthful, so alive in comparison.
There you go. So thanks for coming on, guys. Thank you everybody for listening to the droning of three old men, and we'll see you next week. Bye bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.